Topic one, the erosion of our civil liberties. Your moderator this evening, Herbert Grossman. Our guest this evening is Lynn Kastner, Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union. Lynn, welcome to topic one.
Thank you, Herb. It's a pleasure to be here tonight.
It's quite a provocative title. We have the erosion of our civil liberties. I presume you have some strong feelings about our civil liberties. And secondly, I would gather you feel they may be being eroded. Are both statements correct?
Well, Herb, I would say that the American Civil Liberties Union as an organization, as a nationwide organization, is committed to the proposition that there is a continuous, is testimony to the fact that there is continuous attack on our civil liberties. I think perhaps in these most recent years, we are experiencing a greater attack on all of our civil liberties than at any time in the history of our country. Now, I think this can be defended, but where I think we can get agreement on that. But when it comes to the cause or the nature of the attack, I think perhaps here there is an area for discussion.
Well, let's get into that. What are the manifestations of the greater attack in recent years on our civil liberties? Certainly, if one looks back to the 20s and the Palmer raids, certainly the, what was it, the Know-Nothing parties that in our political sphere, these seem to have disappeared. You don't get the lynchings that you formerly did. There seems to be a great growth of tolerance, and it would seem to me all these things, perhaps obliquely, but they do point perhaps to a greater acceptance of the idea of civil liberties. But you feel that, in truth, our civil liberties are under greater attack today than they have been in the past.
Let's take some specific examples you mentioned. The Civil Liberties Union was organized in 1920 as the only, and still is, the only nonpartisan organization devoted solely to defense of rights under our Constitution and laws. In the 1920s, the group was organized principally around the defense of the right of persons to conscientiously object, the rights of freedom of expression of persons in expressing anti-war sentiments during that period, the days of the Palmer raids, as you mentioned, the organization of the labor unions, the beginning organization of the labor unions. And today there is a parallel. The reaction, the popular reaction against anti-war protests in our Vietnam policy, for example, I think is a strong parallel, and the attacks are much the same as they were in the 1920s. The Civil Liberties Union finds itself fighting the same battles again and again, year after year. The people forget what our liberties are, and though we make progress in many areas in the in our courts, the same kinds of attacks are made year after year.
Well, two things strike me. The first is that it seems to me that civil liberties come under the strongest stress when the country is at war. Would this be true?
No question about that. Or when the country is in, when the national security of the country is in danger, this is often the excuse for either repressive legislation or repressive executive action or police action on both the state and national levels. The three examples of federal legislation, Communist Control Act, the Smith Act of 1950, were enacted during the 1950s, the McCarthy era, when the country first began to recognize the nature and extent of the international communist threat. And although this was not a period of or a time of war, the repressive legislation and the subsequent repressive effect on our civil liberties, on our individual freedoms, was felt in this climate.
Well, then the outlook for civil liberties may be under quite a cloud, because certainly in the foreseeable future, it's almost with our assuming the status of a world power, which we really have assumed fairly recently in recorded history, where we have made a complete negation of any isolationism. We have taken over our position as one of, or the leading nation in the world, engaged in a conflict, not a war perhaps, but certainly an ideological conflict, really that one sees no foreseeable end to. Is it not in a environment like this that you will tend to have great onslaughts on civil liberties?
I think as long as these, as our society will continue to grow and become more complex, some of the factors you mentioned, in the, not only an expanding economy, but an expanding influence in the world, is going to create more and more problems for a basic instrument which has been, which was drafted many years ago, and the more complex we become, the more often is going to be posed the question, is the Bill of Rights a viable enough instrument, a flexible enough document under which to pattern our life and to delineate our liberties? Today being Bill of Rights Day, it's a good time to stop and reflect on what these basic rights are and what they mean to us in the 1960s. We've mentioned some of the particular liberties which have been civil liberties problems which have been under attack a number of years ago and which are present with us yet today. It might be useful to mention a few more, and perhaps by just naming a number of problem areas that the Civil Liberties Union has been interested in, we can perhaps explore some of them in more detail.
Lynn, I would like to, but before we do, probably what we're doing is generalizing, and perhaps the two generalizations that we might make is the one that we have made, that in view of our world situation, our situation internally and externally, that in times like these, civil liberties tend to become less popular. And the second point that I have felt is that, and I don't know if you agree with me or not, but really us civil liberties are never really very popular, are they?
They're not popular because it's they must be defended only, they're under attack when it pinches us in their use. Nobody would argue with the freedom of expression or the freedom of expression of someone we agree with, or according rights of due process to someone we know is innocent, or the treatment equally of people we wish to treat equally. But when each of these basic rights come under attack, with first people we disagree with, perhaps even people who, if successful, could destroy our own way of life, whether it be fascism or Nazism or other totalitarian doctrine, or according rights in our courts and under our due process of law to people whom we believe are guilty, or even perhaps who have been shown to have committed an offense, and yet in the course of the punishment of the offense, we find that in the administration of justice there have been a breakdown, either in the conduct by the police or in the conduct by officials of the court, which have caused these two rights to conflict. Or the equal treatment of people whom individuals or many individuals dislike. It's in these areas, the extreme areas, that that civil liberties become unpopular. And then often those who defend the civil liberties of persons and causes that are unpopular are identified with these causes and these people.
Well, the truth of the matter is, Lynn, the majority does not need a civil liberties union. When you're in the majority, you don't have to defend your right to speak. It's only when you are in the minority, and relatively in a small minority, that the whole question comes up.
That's true. The Bill of Rights was not enacted as an instrument of majority rule. And again and again, and I think we'll go into this in more detail a little bit later on, there are a number of ways to measure acceptance and popularity of various liberties, various civil liberties questions, being done all the time. And if we put right after right that's guaranteed to us in the Bill of Rights to a vote, we'd have very little left of the Bill of Rights. For instance, when we get to censorship, we can talk about what Minnesotans think about official censoring our literature in terms of a majority thinking there should be censorship. There are a number of other polls and indications that have shown that where rights are being tested, if we were to vote on them, we'd lose these rights.
Well, recently, a week or two ago, I believe, the Supreme Court handed down, I believe, a unanimous decision granting certain rights to the Communist Party. A poll afterwards, I believe, showed a very small percentage of the people really favored this decision. There was quite a bit of roar about it. A lot of people objected very strenuously. And yet the fact is that it was a unanimous decision of the Supreme Court. And I wonder if you could briefly give us the background of that decision and your opinions on it.
Well, the Civil Liberties Union filed a brief in that case, and in every case involving the registration provisions of the federal legislation involved, opposing the federal legislation, opposing the registration divisions, and this has consistently been our policy since the 1950s. I think it's interesting to talking before we get to what the substantial rights are that are involved and how they might affect all of us, to look at the size and the nature of the communist threat as it has been defined by Congress at the time of the enactment of the legislation and as it is now. The Communist Party has shrunk according to, I think, figures that most people are familiar with, from the tens of thousands in the 1950s to something under 10,000 now. The nature of this threat, the objective danger of this group as a threat, I think has decreased. I think it's decreased because in direct proportion to the increase in the awareness and protection of our rights of freedom of expression. I think we're in less danger when groups like the Communist Party, like any fascist party, any other totalitarian threat, are exposed and open to public debate and criticism. The court, I think, is affirming a very basic principle in this and a number of other cases by again and again coming back to, is this a clear and present danger, a real threat to our society? Is this set of facts and circumstances? We find this is the basis of many of our laws, and yet when we get into the area of ideas, the courts have, or the repressive laws have attacked our freedoms in two areas. Areas of obscenity, of censorship of obscenity, and in the area of unpopular political ideas. In no other aspect that I can think of in our present society does the criminal law attempt to punish something other than an act or a real threat.
Well, what are some of the issues that you are working on in Minnesota today? Lynn, could you kind of brief us on that a little?
Well, I think perhaps the most important or crucial issue facing us in civil liberties that we have been working with recently are the current state of our mental commitment laws. We, as an organization, nationally, and many of our affiliates have taken individual cases of persons deprived of their civil liberties, either in mental commitment or as a result of commitment. And in Minnesota, we have only become actively interested in this area in the past year. I think the first case that that was a real turning point for us occurred just about a year ago. I got a call at home on Christmas Eve from a woman who said, "I'm locked up in a hospital. I've been trying for 3 weeks to call my lawyer and to call my family doctor, and they won't let me use the telephone. I've tried to call my friends in the city, and they won't let me use the telephone. This is the first time I've been able to call outside. Can you help me?" She told me where she was.
Lynn?
Yes.
Is this legal?
No. And why don't you hear me out for a couple of minutes, and I think when we finish the story, and it's so shocking, it almost seems like fiction.
But Lynn, as a good Perry Mason watcher, I know you're entitled to that one phone call.
Well, she finally got the phone call 3 weeks after she should have gotten the phone call. And it came out that it was a routine practice and procedure. Telephone calls are not allowed persons being held for commitment. Well, we sent a volunteer attorney over. And by the way, all of the legal cases we take are by attorneys who have their own private practices or who work for various companies, who volunteer their time to give their services without professional fee to take cases that the Civil Liberties Union decides to take. And maybe I better digress another minute and explain how we make these decisions. We have 800 attorneys taking cases across the country, and 70,000 members belong to the Civil Liberties Union. 36 affiliates. Minnesota is one of them. We have about 2,000 members in Minnesota who elect a board of directors. The board then manages the business and adopts the policy of the union in Minnesota and decides these issues and cases as they come up. They appoint various committees, and we have a committee on due process and legal redress. Complaints and requests for assistance are screened by these committees. Recommendations are made to the board, and the board makes the decisions of what action we take, representing the membership. Well, in this case, to investigate it, we sent an attorney over to interview the woman, and we found out that she was a 49-year-old woman who had gone to the university off and on for a number of years. She had been a federal civil service employee and had worked at various jobs pretty consistently for a number of years. She had a real conflict situation with her family, who came from a small rural town in Minnesota. And during a period of unemployment, she had gone home. And her parents were very, very much against her attending the university and frightened by her having an education. They signed a petition for her commitment as mentally ill. She didn't know this. She was picked up by the sheriff, taken to the hospital. She was not shown a copy of the petition. She was not allowed to see or call a lawyer. And on the advice of her parents, or testimony of her parents, in the petition, the court ordered her held for observation. During this period, she was held for 3 weeks, all this before she had a hearing, before she had an opportunity to see a lawyer or to bring her own witnesses.
Well, Lynn, when the court ordered her held for observation, was she physically before the court at this time?
No.
Never?
No, this was an ex parte order.
You mean to say just because her mother presented, in effect, a signed letter, maybe notarized, yeah, or maybe not, to a judge saying, "I think my daughter is sick, sick, sick," she is whisked out of society?
Exactly. That's just what happened. During this period, she was lucky. She was lucky. She only was given drugs. Some of the other cases we've handled, there have been shock treatments, forcibly administered, drugs given against their will. During this period, before they have an opportunity to get to the court and assert their basic constitutional rights. Well, to bring this story to a conclusion, the probate court held a hearing in the hospital, and at this time she was represented by our counsel, who was presented witnesses on her behalf. She was allowed to be present at a hearing. which is very unusual, by the way. Most commitment hearings, the people are not present during the commitment. She was allowed to, through her attorney, cross-examine the examining doctor, and the court found that she was not mentally ill and did not commit her.
Well,
she was released. She left the hospital at the conclusion of the hearing.
Lynn, what is the basic requirement that the judge is charged by law that he must find before a person can be committed?
You raise an interesting question of due process. The probate code, the commitment law in Minnesota, does not provide any standard or definition of mental illness. So it only speaks in terms of, let's see if I have the actual statute. The statute only speaks in terms of mental illness, commitment of the mentally ill. It doesn't define what mental illness is.
Well, before you go on, Lynn, it's almost a fantastic statute, because mental illness is such a vague concept. Who by somebody's definition walking around today is not mentally ill, really?
This is the terrible problem, the awful responsibility that is being given to our probate courts, and it's a responsibility that our judges should not have to bear without a law or under a law which does not adequately define what they're trying to find. So in practice, what happens is that they look to the medical testimony, they look to the doctors to say, is this person sick or not sick? If he's sick, a commitment can routinely be had.
Well, Lynn, when you say they look to the doctors, does that mean any medical doctor can certify a person ill, or?
Yes, it does not have to be a psychiatrist. It can be a lay, or it can be a general practitioner. Why don't we start at the beginning? The first step in a mental commitment in Minnesota is the filing of a petition, which alleges, which states that a person is mentally ill. Now, Minnesota is in the distinct minority of jurisdictions which permit any person to file a petition. Most states, and the draft act is developed by the American Bar Association, limit the right to special groups or classes of persons. That is, say, a public official with a welfare department or in some position of responsibility, or a relative, or someone who's affected by the person's behavior. But in Minnesota, a stranger can file a petition.
Well, do you mean to say that my neighbors across the hall who have been trampling over my gardenia bed these last 6 months, I can go out tomorrow and sign a petition and have him, if I can find a friendly doctor, have him committed?
This has happened. In a number of cases, a stranger with absolutely no relation, either as a relative or in some other relationship to the person, has signed the petition. And Minnesota does not require that supporting evidence accompany the petition before a person is picked up. As a matter of fact, the law has been interpreted by our courts in decisions under the law that a probate court must act on any petition. They do not have the discretion to refuse to act. So we have here, first, anyone can file it. Secondly, it does not require supporting evidence. And thirdly, the court must entertain it, must act upon it. Now, what happens when a petition is filed?
Well, Lynn, may I ask one question? By the court must act, that means the court must decide. They don't automatically, upon the filing of the petition, have to detain the person, do they?
Well, what the case law said that I was talking about, it arose in a situation where a probate court refused to entertain the petition. And the probate court act is mandatory, so the court must go through the steps provided in the in the law and must accept the petition. Now, there are different ways in which the commitment can come about. There are different subdivisions, and we can spend a little time discussing these. Now, the arrest procedures before hearing are without notice. The petition is... if the petition alleges that the person is dangerous and in need of treatment, the law contains a provision permitting the party to be restrained and placed in a hospital on the certification of a licensed physician, that he has examined the person, that he is of the opinion that the person is ill and likely to cause injury to himself and others unless immediately restrained. Now, under this, the restraint cannot exist over 72 hours without a hearing being held. Now, this is pretty fair.
Well, what about your woman, though? She was held, you told me, for weeks.
All right, let me go on. On the other hand, the first portion of the same statute permits the court, without any finding of a likelihood of injury to the patient or others, the court to ex parte, without notice, simply issue an order to the sheriff to pick up a patient for confinement for observation and examination. This is what happened to the woman. And as a matter of fact, under this procedure, this is the routine procedure followed in many of the cases that have come to our attention. And I believe that we'd find that this is quite common through most of the counties in the state.
Well, why don't you describe to us a common procedure, or some of those that have come up?
Under this procedure, there's no stated limit as to the length of time that a person can be held for examination and observation. And such confinement does not require a prior setting of a date, time, and place of hearing on the proposed commitment. One of our volunteer lawyers had a complaint from a woman who has been held for over a year without any judicial hearing. The woman that the Civil Liberties Union had released about a year ago was held for 3 weeks. The gentleman that we just obtained the release for in the last few weeks, Albert Falk, had been held for almost a year. In that case, it was a commitment to a federal veterans hospital, but the commitment was by a state court, and it was under our Minnesota Commitment Act. Let me just run through what happened to him. A petition was signed and sent to the court. He was picked up. Actually, he was in the hospital at the time a petition was filed, because he had gone in for arrest and for treatment of some physical ailment. In this case, Falk has spent about 50 years traveling all over the country, espousing various causes. He has a peace plan and a war on poverty. He was a peace lobbyist in Congress a number of years ago. And he's been arrested literally hundreds of times all over the country. And while in Florida, and incidentally, the Civil Liberties Union has had occasion to defend him a number of times against illegal harassment by police and preventing him from selling his literature. He was beaten up by police in Florida and sustained an injury to his back. His home is in Minnesota, in a small town out in western Minnesota. And he came back to Minnesota to rest up and, being a World War I veteran, signed himself into the hospital to receive treatment for his back and to gain his strength back. Well, they wanted him to see the psychiatrist and to commence some kind of treatment. At least this is what we understand. And he refused. And following this, then a petition for commitment was filed.
Who signed it, by the way?
The head of the welfare department in his home county. And
had this head of the welfare department spent any time observing Falk?
No, not that we know of, and Falk didn't even know him. He didn't know who signed the petition. He didn't know because he'd never seen it. He was taken from the hospital by people that he did not know. We believe they were employees of the hospital, although the hospital did not contest the court action that was brought, so we don't know for sure. All we know is that he was taken from the hospital to the probate court in Moorhead, Minnesota. The court did not introduce itself to him. He wasn't told why he was there. He was not shown the petition for commitment, and the judge told him that it was in the county, in the other county where the welfare official had signed it. He said, "I have a lawyer in my hometown. I'd like to have him represent me." The judge made a call. The lawyer was not available, was not in town, so they proceeded anyway. There was an attorney appointed to represent him, but the attorney did not speak at all during the hearing. No testimony was received. He wasn't aware that there was an attorney in the room.
What was this attorney doing?
The attorney did nothing. He was, the judge told him, an attorney has been appointed to represent you, but he had no opportunity to confer with the man, and he didn't know who it was. There were a couple of people in the courtroom, Falk testified, and he said he didn't know who they were. No testimony of any kind was received, and he was committed on the basis of a judicial proceeding that took no evidence at all. So there was no testimony. He was denied then the right to cross-examine. He was denied the right of counsel, denied the right to present witnesses on his behalf, and denied the right of a continuance to prepare his case. The whole proceeding, from the time he was taken to the courthouse till he was legally committed, or in this case illegally committed, was 10 minutes. Well, the leading case in Minnesota testing our commitment laws, or measuring them against our standards of due process, held a four-hour commitment. This is a case of Hussman versus Hirsch. As a matter of fact, it was a commitment to St. Cloud Veterans Hospital, the same hospital, as violating due process. Well, this whole thing took only 10 minutes, and he was then held in a locked ward for over a year before he was finally able, before he finally had legal representation. And he was freed then with a habeas corpus petition, which, and as you know, brings a petition to a judge of the district court and states in a sworn statement by the person that the following things have happened and that they deny his constitutional rights. The court then ordered the person brought before him, and together with the warrant of commitment, the legal reason for commitment. Well, the hospital brought him before the court and brought the commitment order from the probate court, but did not contest the commitment.
Lynn, one of the things that strikes me as being so grossly disturbing about this is that he spent a year incarcerated, in effect, locked up. If it had not been for the habeas corpus, he might, I presume, still be there. Now, it seems to me you have to have a prison sentence of about 3 years before you spend a year in prison. You have all this tremendous and good, let me say in good, I mean, this is what makes our system, safeguards before you can send a man to prison for a comparable period of time. And yet, as you say, this whole procedure took 10 minutes.
The frightening thing is, and if this were not enough, the many people being held for observation are given medical treatment against their will before the hearing. We've had a case called to our attention by an attorney in Minneapolis who represented someone as appointed counsel. And at the hearing, the man was brought in, and two of the items of evidence that were considered in his commitment were that he didn't remember that Eisenhower was president, and he couldn't subtract 7 from 100. They had a rehearing on the commitment, and it turned out that the man had been under drugs at the time of the hearing. He was subsequently released, and he is now the head of an accounting department of a large corporation. There is that much difference in behavior because of the medical treatment, the drugs administered prior to a court seeing a person being held for commitment for the first time.
Well, what deeply disturbs me is this whole concept of mental illness being the criteria for commitment. Certainly, as one gets sophisticated psychologically, this whole conception of mental illness becomes a very cloudy one. I mean, Is it psychosis? Is it neurosis? Certainly both are mental illness. In a way, mental illness is probably just as vague as physical illness. Say you had a law saying that when a man was ill, something could happen. What is being ill? Is it waking up with an upset stomach? Or is it having terminal cancer? Both, in a way, are ill. And certainly, if you were, the minute you set before any person, be he a judge, a county attorney, or a person in any authority, the right to, well, incarcerate or just deprive of your civil liberties based on a conception so vague as mental illness, it kind of becomes quite frightening. But, I mean, have our courts been willing to go along with this conception of mental illness as being a criteria?
Interestingly enough, our courts have had almost no opportunity to really look at this question in the light of civil liberties standards. The only Supreme Court case, for instance, that that has come to our attention recently, in the U.S. Supreme Court, involved a Washington, D.C. law which provided that if a person was found not guilty by reason of insanity, he was automatically committed to the Elizabeth Hospital there. The Supreme Court in that case held that that just the fact that he had a successful defense, that a jury found him not guilty by reason of insanity, was not enough to find him mentally ill, and there had to be a separate court determination on whether he was ill enough to be incarcerated in a hospital.
Well, then why hasn't our Supreme Court gotten, the state Supreme Court, gotten a chance to review our procedures here?
I suppose it's something just as simple as the fact that most attorneys are not aware that this is going on. Persons being committed, I'm sure a good many of them are not given access to the courts and to legal advice. And the case, frankly, has not been presented. The case of what constitutes mental illness for the purposes of commitment, what degree of illness must there be before a person is incarcerated, has not been presented. The state Supreme Court cases that we have used and that have aided the people we have represented have dealt with the procedures involved in commitment and depriving persons of specific constitutional rights, such as the adequate notice. Falk, incidentally, received no notice he was going to be committed. Time to prepare for a hearing, the right to present evidence and witnesses, the right to have an attorney, the right to compulsory process, the basic rights that anyone faced with a deprival of or with incarceration or imprisonment is entitled to. These basic rights of due process have been the only questions that the Supreme Court has faced.
Jim, I'm disappointed about this, because let's assume that every one of these peripheral rights were protected. It still seems to me that there is a glaring question here over the basic right of the state, and it is the state acting, really, to incarcerate somebody because he is mentally ill. It reminds me, I think the book was Erewhon by Butler, where they present this topsy-turvy society, where they did put away the people who were physically sick. But I cannot see why, because somebody is, quote, mentally ill, the state has the right to whisk him out of its structure.
The lawyers that represent persons committed, in making a defense where there has been a hearing on the merits of whether a person is ill, in the cases that have come to my attention, seem quite naturally to go to the question, is this person dangerous to himself or to others? And I think that question, although it's not stated in that language in any way in the statute, is very much in the minds of the committing court. I presume in the minds of many doctors who testify, of is this person dangerous?
Well,
then there is a second question of, is this person in need of treatment? And in the case of the woman we freed last year, there was uncontradicted medical evidence that she was in need of treatment. But there was a very real question of whether she was dangerous. And as a matter of fact, the evidence was not contradicted, that she was not dangerous to herself or to others.
Well, certainly, I think this is one of the things that we can both agree on and should be made perfectly clear, that not all mentally ill people are dangerous. I should say, if you define mental illness broadly enough, and it's certainly subject to broad interpretation, I should say a very small minority of those mentally ill are dangerous. This concept of mental illness just disturbed me. I have had my own periods of quite pronounced depression. I think we all have periods where we know we're not operating up to par. By somebody's definition, this might be mental illness, just as a slight fever is physical illness. This might be a slight manifestation of mental illness. Well, according to what I've heard here, under this definition, I could be committed. Or anybody could be. As you say, as a practical matter, maybe they're not. I can see, obviously, if most probate judges, in fact, all I've ever come in contact with are reasonable human beings, most judges are. And I'm sure most genuinely have a desire to see justice done, and they're not going to do this. But this really begs the question, doesn't it?
I think the real concern of the Civil Liberties Union has to be focused on the law that makes it possible. That we might say that your commitment is not likely. I think we could agree on that.
Well, let's hope so.
But under the state of the law as it is, I think we could agree it could happen.
It very well could happen.
And that is the concern, the state of the law. Can the law be improved to guarantee the rights that are guaranteed, that are belong to all of us under the Constitution? This concern is the first interest of the Civil Liberties Union. And we have seen as an organization in our own complaint experience, in our own experience in court over the past year, that we must do more once we see that this is a widespread problem, that the state of the law as it is makes these things possible. It's not enough to defend the people who deserve defense, who call to our attention their individual problems. And we feel impelled to go further and to say we must develop a legislative program.
Of course.
Legislative reform.
Because one of the things I should point out is that once you're called into the picture, the damage is already done. You cannot give Mr. Falk back his year. You know, and certainly what you're doing should be done, has to be done, but it does not really solve the problem because, again, when you get the person out on habeas corpus, he's already been torn out of the society. He may have the drugs administered. Now, one of the things that occasionally bothers me as I view Minnesota law, you take a question like this: is anybody really strongly in favor of our commitment procedures as they exist today? Is there any group that's in favor of them? Has anyone come to you really with strength and vehemence said, no, our commitment laws are correct?
No, I really haven't. I haven't heard anyone in the past year of experience that I've had with the organization and working with its complaints and this aspect of our program. I haven't heard any expression of opinion that amounted to a defense of the law as it presently exists. Now, I personally have not participated in the discussions that have taken place in the past legislative sessions over legislative reform. But in my experience with some of the people serving on these commissions are members of ours and are working with us and are serving on our own committee. And there are there are many different interests expressed in a legislative form in developing a law such as this. The judges, for instance, will have a certain set of concerns that grow out of their own experience in commitment proceedings. The medical profession, on the other hand, will have perhaps a different set of concerns growing out of their own experience and their own responsibilities. Lawyers and other groups of our society will also have concerns on the same problem, which reflect their own area of experience. And in many cases, I think some of these concerns can conflict.
Lynn, let me just say at this point that if anybody listening would care to come on with me and show why they feel the law should be as it is, I would be most happy to welcome them. Because when we sat down here this evening, I had a vague feeling of uneasiness about our commitment procedures. I read a story or two that they weren't all quite what they should be. But it one of the troubles with the law is that it doesn't affect that many people. We don't run in my life, I have not run into contact with anybody personally who was committed. And I sometimes think that not in our state particularly, but in every state, in every system of law, the worst laws are the laws that affect the fewest amount of people. What is being done to change this law?
I have to take issue with part of your statement.
Oh, good.
When you say it's a law which affects a few amount of people, a report of the mentally disabled in the law, University of Chicago, 1961, pointed out that in 1957, there were 1,430,000 persons in mental institutions, and during the previous year, over 500,000 mentally disabled persons were voluntarily admitted or involuntarily hospitalized in mental institutions. Statistical projections indicate that at the present rate of hospitalization, one out of every 12 citizens will probably spend a portion of his life in a mental institution, and thousands of mentally disabled persons are adjudged incompetent and placed under guardianship each year. I think that there's no question but that the amount, the degree of the problem is substantial.
Well, but in all fairness, certainly of those millions of people, I should think, though come to think of it, maybe it is a question that most of them have a feeling, well, they should be committed. Though I guess you don't really know, because...
Well, this projection will say that one out of 12 persons will be committed. This is based on the rate of hospitalization. You're right, there is an unanswered question of how many of those need commitment. But the question that should really concern us is, as long as, especially since there's the degree of hospitalization is as great as it is, we should concern ourselves with the procedures and the means of commitment.
Well, I maybe we have a real dichotomy, not a basic opinion, but a focus here. Because again, going back to the fact that one of 12 is, it seems to me the first step you've got to do is get mental illness off the book and sharply define what a person has to, if you want, be guilty of before he can be committed. Certainly it cannot be mental illness. I mean, even if you give him every procedure in the world safeguarding him, as long as the court has it before it the question, is this man mentally ill, you have a tremendously upsetting law on the books affecting potentially, as you say, one out of 12 people.
Yes. And the difficulty is that this is going to be the hardest problem in legislative reform, I feel. It's going to be easiest to suggest, I think, to suggest procedural safeguards, to point out the weaknesses in the law that allow a person to be arrested without notice, held without a chance to contact his doctor, deprived of the right by a hospital, let's say, to make phone calls or to contact his lawyer or family or friends. These are very easily definable and easily ascertainable facts. And I think that that the law, the structure of the law, where it abuses these rights or where it fails to provide safeguards for these rights, are the first things that we can solve. But when we come to the real question of what standards a committing court must use to determine whether a person is committable, is going to be more difficult.
Yes, I feel, but
we need the help and we're going to have the help and the support of not only the medical profession but of many professions besides law to arrive at an answer to this question that will not only satisfy society but satisfy the basic requirements of the Constitution.
Well, without being an authority on anything, or perhaps sometimes thinking myself an authority on everything, the criteria to me would have to be danger, whether danger to others or danger to self, I'm not sure. Perhaps you could argue this, but certainly if a man, I recoil at the idea of committing a man who is not dangerous and who has not committed a crime. The minute you give to the government the right to incarcerate a man for his own good, you set a very dangerous precedent, wouldn't you say?
And a precedent which has not been set in any other area. The Constitution, I think we would agree, the Constitution
yes.
prohibits this. I can't personally think of any court cases or cases where the law has imposed medical treatment on persons, on adults, against their will, unless when they're able to exercise their will. A person injured in an automobile accident, unconscious, or bleeding, or in shock, can receive medical treatment without giving his permission. But a conscious adult who knows he has a fatal illness can certainly refuse treatment. And it's only been in the area of where parents have refused to have their children treated that I can recall, where the court has stepped in and said the law requires the protection of the life of the child, and we have an obligation to, the child has a right to live, and we will affirm that right, even though the parents may deny it to us. And the only exception to this area is in the realm of mental illness.
Getting back to Mr. Fault, this becomes a particularly dangerous, really, precedent, because the basis, really, as you described it, of his illness was his political beliefs. The feeling was anybody who did all these, quote, screwy type things must be sick. But certainly as we look back on certain political movements in their infancy, a lot of people considered them sick.
Falk is, I think, correctly pointed to by you as an example of someone who is incarcerated because of his behavior, of his nonconformity. In 1936, he showed up in Congress, lobbying for what he called at that time a war on poverty. Called for a government pension for everyone who was out of work, a forerunner to our own unemployment security. And he was incarcerated in a mental institution at that time. The complaint experience of our national office and the groups that have done studies, I think, have shown that a high incidence of commitment centers around behavioral abnormalities, behavioral nonconformity, and conflict in family situations, where conflict between parents and children, between husband and wife.
Lynn, is there an active group or perhaps individuals who are conscientiously trying in the next legislative session to change this law?
Yes, there's been an... I'm not sure whether there has been a commission appointed, whether an interim commission has actually been appointed. I think there is, and I know the individuals that have worked on it, and whether they are officially a commission or not, I don't know, but men such as Ray Reister and Douglas Head and other men have worked and done good work in working on our probate code. I know that even if it is an interim commission, it's not staffed. And I think from our point of view, we have set out for ourselves the task of coming up with comprehensive legislative suggestions. There is a sense of urgency because I think we need to try and do the whole job soon so we can bring our views to every group that is concerned with it and to the public well enough in advance so there can be full debate and discussion before the next legislative session. I don't think we can afford to wait till 1969.
Or 1984.
Yes.
Well, Lynn, let us hope so. I see, besides the erosion of our civil liberties, we're having a rapid erosion of our time. Perhaps briefly we might spend some time on some other things that you have been working here in Minnesota with.
Well, mental commitment, I think, is a good example of of one of our civil liberties problem areas that people have not been too aware of. Some of the other problem areas have been the subject of much public debate and discussion. For instance, a little over a year ago, most people are aware that the House Committee on Un-American Activities held its hearings in Minneapolis. And at that time, the Minnesota branch provided volunteer attorneys to represent 10 of the 11 persons subpoenaed to appear before the committee at its hearings. Following this, a man was discharged from his union. A witness subpoenaed before the committee was subsequently discharged from his union. Another was discharged from city employment. In both cases, civil liberties union volunteer lawyers have and are representing them. Both cases are still pending. In another area, a problem area that has recently commanded our attention, we have faced problems of official censorship of reading material for adults which we feel violate the Constitution. The recent action of the Metropolitan Airports Commission this last July in passing a resolution instructing their staff to ask the two news dealers at the airport to remove certain named items of literature, certain books, is going to be the subject of legal action fairly shortly.
Lynn, there's one area that I think may have been a big problem. Is it still? And that is the rights of the Indians of our state.
We have, just this past summer, sent a field worker to northern Minnesota to study the administration of justice affecting the Minnesota Indian. We originally set up a six-week project, and as it turned out, we can barely scratch the surface with this. The study has been completed. I've made a number of trips there myself, and a report is being prepared. I see as the time is flying by that as we mentioned these many things, we could easily spend a full hour talking about any one of them. And if some of them interest you further, I'd be more than happy to explore some of these other areas in the future.
Well, then, perhaps it's an appropriate time to let our voices drop a little because the time has just about elapsed. But I would very much appreciate your returning to explore further some of these areas. What has impressed me very much this evening as we talked was that if enough people knew about it, I feel this law would not be on the books. And perhaps I have a feeling of this about quite a few laws that are existent that shouldn't be. Len, we want to thank you very much for appearing on Topic One this evening. Our guest has been Len Kastner, Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union. This is Topic One, your host, Herbert Grossman. I might just close by adding that if any of our listeners do have feelings contrary to the ones expressed here this evening, we'd be most happy to hear from them, to have them on this program. Thank you for listening.
That's about it.